Okay, I'm back after a brief unintentional hiatus, but we're back with a bang. This is such a special episode to me because it is the first time that I've interviewed someone who I actually know, and also I'm interviewing someone who has had just such an impact on my life and I think the lives of a lot of kids at the high school that I attended and graduated from, which is Beacon High School. I'm going to give some context to kind of my relationship with Mr. Moskow so that this interview isn't terribly confusing. So when I was in my sophomore year, I took Mr. Moskow's global history class. I don't know what my life would look like now if not for Mr. Moskow and for my whole sophomore year, which was, first of all, online, so yeah. And second of all, it was the first year where I really started to kind of discover intellectual curiosity. So I really did just start to discover like a love for learning. And I also started to discover that I had a natural inclination towards interviewing. So I had to do an English project where I made a podcast. And that was also my sophomore year. And that was super key in realizing that I could do this and just learning fundamental tools of, you know, how to edit a podcast. And then also, I really kind of took off with this idea when I had Mr. Moskow's class and was interviewing a expert on Marxism for a history project that we had to do that was not necessarily, it didn't have a podcasting component, but I ended up doing podcasting as sort of an extra credit thing, because Mr. Moskow, if you've had him, you know he gives a lot of extra credit opportunities throughout the school year, and you really can take advantage of however little or however much extra credit you want, which is one of the things I always appreciated about his classes. So then I did that interview, and I realized that people were actually very open to talking to me, someone who is not an expert, and I realized that I did have questions to ask, and, you know, if you have questions to ask, then go for it, why not, is kind of my philosophy. So he's also really, really gotten me into reading. I think, again, it's a combination of it was just the right time. I had a lot of time on my hands to just start reading again in sophomore year, but also Mr. Moskow constantly urging people to read more. So I am going on a little bit of a tangent, but I know for a fact that Mr. Moskow has made such a tremendous impact on my life, and I'm not alone in this. So as for this episode, I had him once in my sophomore year, was not chosen, but I had him for the full year. And then again in my senior year, we have half year long classes of history. So I took two history classes my senior year, and we got to pick those two classes. One of them I took my first semester was International Political Economy with Mr. Moskow. And so you will hear me referring to both International Political Economy, which is a class I took my senior year, and also Global History, which was a class I took my sophomore year. Yeah, oh, the other thing I wanted to explain quickly was that in our school, we also have New York Times front page quizzes, which you'll hear us talk about New York Times, just to show that you have been reading the front page to kind of establish a habit. And so that's what we mean when we talk about that. I hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. It was very, very surreal for me to do this and such a cool experience that I will always be grateful for. I remember when I was in sophomore year, you said you had like a teaching philosophy. And I don't know if you remember what you said, but I definitely do. Do you think you know?
I mean, I think I do. So let's see. Who knows what I said to you in sophomore year? But let's see. I think I said that a history teacher should get kids to try to read the newspaper and should get people to vote or participate in the democratic process in some way or another. In other words, like, to know what's going on in the world and then to sort of act on that information. Did I get it correct?
So I remember, and again, like, this is my memory, so I could be wrong too, but I remember the news was the big one. And I think that's like a thing that we do at our school in general. And also reading just books in general was the other big one. So with your extra credit, do you want to talk about that? Because I always found that very interesting and helpful as a student.
Yeah, so I do try to structure my classes so that kids get extra credit. In fact, they get as much extra credit as they want by reading books, whole books. I try to pick in 10th grade, which is a global history class. I try to pick historical fiction just because I love it so much, and I think it's a great way to learn history. In 12th grade economics, political economy, not as much of that. But I try to pick fun books. My sense, you as a young person can tell me, but my sense, if your generation is anything like my generation, people aren't reading all that much anymore. And what they are reading is fragmented. They surf the web, their social media feeds. So this, it's called surfing for a reason, right? Like, there's not a lot of depth there when you read like that. And there's something about sticking with an author for a book through their whole argument. I tend to think, but we can talk about it if you want, that the medium is very important. So, like, actually reading physical books that matter. And there's a guy named Marshall McLuhan, which is pretty important, and another guy named Neil Postman, who both been really influential in terms of my thinking about this, about why the medium, matters so much. So I do try to encourage kids to go to our library. We have, we have all these books from over the years that people collected that kids are reading with extra credit, and actually, take the book home with them, read on the subway, but read actual books. I think again, we can talk about it more if you want, but I think it changes the brain. It does something to the mind, and I think it's very positive for the individual, and I think maybe for the larger for society as well.
I have a couple different things to talk about there. So I was going to talk about the news more and media. Do you see reading as an extension of media, or do you see it as like a separate thing? Like news media?
Oh, right. Okay. So, but I think when we talk about media, we want to think about, and maybe it's like a different way of thinking about it, but I think it goes back to McLuhan and Postman. We want to be thinking about, let's say we take the news and watch the news on the television. Their argument, and I think my argument too, would be that it can be the same story. It can actually be the same text, like a newscaster can be reading the same text over the broadcast that you could read in the newspaper. But that would actually have a different impact both on the way you perceive the news and on society. So, in other words, yes, we're talking about media, we're talking about the news, but which medium you consume the news in is very, very important. So, reading a physical newspaper is going to be different than getting your news from the television, as television is mainly a visual medium. And so things have got to move. I'll give you an example. What is the when you watch the evening news, what is on the evening news?
Well, it's a lot of breaking news, flash flood. It's very much a negative. They're making everything seem like a great big emergency type of thing.
Right, for floods, that's great for the news. What else is good for the TV news?
I don't know. I don't know what you're getting at here.
Well, no, when I watch TV news, which is actually not that often, but I used to watch it a lot. It's ambulance lights, burning buildings. It's sports. It's the weather. Every 10 minutes, they give us a weather update, and they show the weather moving across the country. So, in terms of, and if it's politics, it's fast and sound bites. That works for a visual medium. It's not a coincidence that a textual medium like a newspaper is going to deliver the news in a different way, and the news will be different that they present. And I think that will give us a different type of politics, a different type of society. So again, Postman writes this wonderful book that we read, and I read in 9th grade. It was the first Postman book that I read. And it was called How to Watch TV News. And I highly recommend it. He makes that point over and over again that I don't know if you know what C-SPAN is, but it's a cable channel which was started by funded by lots of other cable networks because They had to show that they were basically doing something good for the public. Nobody watches C-SPAN, except political junkies. And there is this show on C-SPAN, which is obviously like really boring, is a guy just reading the New York Times. It doesn't work very well for that medium.
I mean, that reminds me of this thing also, even in just reading it. I know this isn't the point, but in just reading the news, you can kind of put, like, when you're learning grammar, you'll do an exercise where you place the emphasis on different words of a sentence, and that, like, changes the whole meaning of the sentence. But can you differentiate between reading a newspaper and reading a book?
Yes. Well, are you thinking about nonfiction, for example? So, like a
Sure,
book about
yes.
politics? Yeah, I think that, well, I tend to think of history books as being news that happened in the past. So, in that way, they're kind of similar. I do think that there is a tremendous amount of pressure on newspapers to, there is a couple of things. One, get the news out, obviously, very quickly. So, sometimes I think we don't understand the events as they're unfolding very well. And that's a limitation of newspapers. I think that newspapers have a, it goes back to Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's book, Manufacturing Consent, where they say there is an ideological component of newspapers because, it's invisible, but, or almost invisible, but they've got to sell newspapers, but also keep advertisers happy. And so, you wouldn't have Noam Chomsky on the editorial page of the New York Times because I think that it would ruffle feathers with businesses and advertisers. And that's not so much a concern with books. And that brings us to, I think, another point that I think is really important is that books are the last refuge in a society that's inundated with advertising. It's literally the only place you can go that where there's no ads. Obviously, there's ads on the radio, there's ads on TV, there's clearly there's ads on the internet. And I think that's important because, I was just listening to you and I both really like the Economic Historian Adam Tooze. I was just listening to the most recent edition of their podcast. It's a great podcast, Ones and Twos. But, they're talking about the foreign policy of Israel and the way that Israel treats Palestinians, and a very serious conversation. And then, like a second later, the co-host is talking about, some food delivery system that Americans love to eat. And I do think that what that does is it not only distracts, but it supposes that the content is of the same worth or value, that what they're talking about with Israel Palestine is equivalent to, what kind of food box you should get. And I think, again, that makes it hard to have serious conversations. So I think that that's another limitation.
I remember you also saying in sophomore year that, especially on Kindle, which already has some advertisements, that there'd be ads in the middle of books.
Yeah, and I don't know which of the e-readers, though it could be all of them at this point, are also, very interested in tracking what you're reading. When you stop in a book, at what point? And that seems like a problem of, a privacy for me, but also, more commodification of information and my personal information, which is, not that exciting for me.
So my other question in relation to the media, this summer, I was very news oriented over the school year, and I still like keep up with the news a little bit, but I have stopped really reading the news a lot. And sure, I will get it from my mom, and I still read books. I've been reading lots of books and nonfiction books as well. But I found also that it's been a little bit refreshing for me to not have a constant stream of like negative things, mainly negative things, like coming at me every day. And so I wonder if you could talk about weighing the depressing effects of news against the need to read it and keep up with everyone around you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, especially in the summer when I have a chance. I like to read as much fiction as possible, and I find myself getting, people talk about like doom scrolling on their phone. I don't have social media, but I do that with, the Times app, with Financial Times and The Guardian, which are three papers that I read. And I gotta stop doing it because I don't feel great while I do it. And I think that If you live in a healthy, robust democracy where you're expected to participate in the civic life, then you have to read the newspaper. If you live in a democracy like ours, which is both fragile and incomplete, and for most of us, for most issues, it's just out of reach. And the place where it's most out of reach is at at the federal level, and certainly at the international level. So, yeah, I do grapple with the question of whether it makes sense for kids to even be reading the newspaper, because if you're going to have a democracy where it's kind of a democracy light and people are spectators, then it's sort of like, following basketball. It can be interesting or entertaining, but if you don't actually have any access to democracy, or if the access is very difficult to achieve, then it can lead people to feel like there's just lots of bad news and there's nothing we can do about it. So, I have a friend who worked for a major US newspaper, and he just, says like it was very difficult for him to pitch stories to his editor, which were about happy things, about good news. I think there's a bias towards negativity, and yeah, I think that's not real healthy.
And, I do think that that's what will sell more newspapers, probably, is focusing on depressing things because, you can kind of fear monger.
I think you may be right, but I think that's worth it's worth exploring. In other words, it would be really neat. There's a small magazine called Yes Magazine, which is only positive stories. It'd be really neat if someone could do some research on, what are the most, I don't know, read or emailed or forwarded stories out there. I wonder if it's really the most negative. But that would be I'd be fascinated. I'd be curious.
I mean,
Sorry, go ahead.
something that made me think of, kind of to counter my own point, I have TikTok. I don't use it to post things. I just scroll, doom scrolling there. But the algorithm has figured out that I really like seeing puppies. And so 90% of my TikTok feed is just like puppies falling on each other. It's really positive, honestly. And I know that when the January 6th stuff was happening, it was a terrible, I like could not go on TikTok because it was seeing that I was watching those videos, but somehow I kind of beat that and now we're back to puppies. And that is what has gotten me the most engaged on TikTok. So I don't know.
That would be interesting.
So also I want to talk about local news. And I know there's not a ton of really good local news stories, but I guess have you ever thought about like finding a local newspaper and making students read that instead?
Well, the last thing I read every night before I go to bed is on my phone is Gothamist, which is run by WNYC, and it's New York news. I love it. And at the bottom of every day they give you a video of the equivalent of like puppies falling all over. It's always animal videos, and that's a nice way to end the day. But I think so. Gothamist, I really appreciate. I love reading when the New York Times has strong Metro section. That was great to read too. But yeah, I think it's a real problem that the New York Times has turned into a national newspaper. It really has made an effort to do that. And at this point, there aren't. I mean, New York is a little different because we have the Post, we have the Daily News. But if you go to a place like some of my family lives in Salt Lake, and you go to Salt Lake, and they used to have a morning, afternoon edition, a couple papers. And now you go look at you buy the paper, and it's basically, a shell, and inside are AP stories. So they buy AP stories, but they don't have many local reporters at all. And this is true, you go, most places in the country. And I think the really scary aspect of it is I think the best thing that newspapers do is that they use their resources to uncover corruption. And at the local level, when you don't have many newspapers, corruption, and there's now lots of, unfortunately, lots of studies which confirm this. It's a way for corruption to flourish. And I don't know what you do about it, except because clearly local news has not been profitable you may have to figure out a way to take sort of the profit motive out of local news. And I would say you might want to think about doing that with all news. And there's a lot of ways you could do it so that it's not government funded, because clearly you don't want profit, you don't want a government finance. Although BBC does a pretty good job, I guess. But I think there are some innovative ways that you could sort of remove profit, and that would solve a lot of our problems.
I mean, do you think that as of right now, the media has become too intertwined with the federal government? Because to me, it also seems like a big part of the problem is the line between the media and politics is blurring.
Well, I think there's a lot of people have written interesting stuff about this. One book that I'm thinking about is called something like, you can look it up, like Chicken Shit Club, but it's actually about, it's, I think the guy won a Pulitzer, but it's about the reason that white collar criminals don't get prosecuted very often. And one of the points that he makes is that many of these people who are working in white collar industry, I mean, he uses the, I think, the 08 financial crisis as his big case study, but many people who are working in these industries, actually grow up, go to school, and send their kids to the same school as people who are in journalism and who are working in DA's office, and that you have a sort of a layer, a social class, which is very intimately bound together. What I think is a problem is that the worldview and assumptions of people who are going into journalism today are closely mirror that of people who are in government or in big business. And that, there was a time in American history where journalism was a profession, an avenue for working class people. That is no longer possible. You are not going to become a journalist for any big newspaper not having a college degree. That used to be possible. So I think social class matters a whole lot. I do think there's the challenge for journalists in trying to keep their sources open and keep their sources closed. I think that's probably always been a problem. I don't know that it's sort of worse today.
So this is not related to media, but it's about books. So I wanted to
Yeah.
ask you two questions about books. One of them is very Ezra Klein. So books that you'd like recommend across the board. And I don't do this because I don't want to copy Ezra Klein, but I do feel like you have so many book recommendations. You give so many book recommendations. So if you could just narrow it down to some that you think are crucial to read for someone who wants to think more deeply, I would say.
One book that I've been recommending to lots of friends is a book called Elite Capture by Olufemi Taiwo. He's a philosopher. He's a professor of philosophy, and he's a philosopher at Georgetown. And I think it's a book that really helps explain a lot of what's going on in the world, from the gamification of our culture to what racial capitalism is, to how elites capture politics. And I recommend it because I think Taiwo is really smart, and it's also kind of an easy read. I think it's a couple hundred pages, and you could probably read it in a few days. And so what I like about him is that he takes really complicated ideas and simplifies them. And for me, maybe it's because I'm just like not that smart, and I'm not being like falsely humble here. Like, I really have a hard time with academic text. I don't understand most of it. It's why I've never really been all that into Marxism, because most Marxist writers are hard to read, and I feel like that's purposeful, right? It's sort of like, if you can have this secret language, and academics across the board do it, you can have a secret language with the language you can justify your life, why you're an academic, why you get the privileges you have. It's part of the reason that, and I'm not always very successful at it, but it's part of the reason why I feel I really like teaching political economy class, because the goal really is for me to simplify and put into plain English a lot of stuff that's needlessly complicated. So I really like Taiwo for that reason. I really like Neopostman, as I said before, and I would recommend that people, maybe start with a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, because I think to kind of go back to the question of, I was thinking about this as you were asking about the problem of politicians being too close to journalists, and this is depressing, but I more and more I think that Postman's argument is the problem is not 1984 and censorship. The problem is that people have access to books, but no one needs to ban them because nobody wants to read anymore. And I so that's the theme of Amusing Ourselves to Death. And I don't know on a larger level what any individual can do about that. I have a daughter who's two now. She'll be about to be two. And we are trying to keep her away from all screens for as long as possible. She doesn't know what, poor girl, she doesn't know what cartoons are. She doesn't know anything. And we're trying to give her, keep her world, like a text-based world. We don't know, some picture books and stuff, but real books. But the tide is very much, not in our favor. And I don't know that how long we'll be able to sustain this. But again, it does nothing about the society-wide question of people being overly interested and distracted by superficial things.
Those superficial things are engineered that way. Like they're engineered to make your brain want more and more of them.
I think so. Postman's writing before the internet, actually. He's really writing about the television age, but everything he's saying about television is just so much more true with the internet. I don't know, and again, this goes back to the medium being the message. I don't know that you can make better content on the phone, on the smartphone. I don't think it allows for depth. So it's really a technological question, and I think the technology has an ideology. In other words, I think there is one view that technology is sort of, a hammer is a hammer, and it's neutral. It's what you do with the hammer, and I'm not sure that that's true.
I feel like I'm coming off as like a TikTok representative, like promoter or something. But I don't know if you know about this, but I mean, I'm sure you have because it's a big thing. But like book talk is a thing now. And it's mainly, I mean, I'll admit it's not like high caliber reading at all. It's mainly like romance books, fantasy books, like that kind of thing. I've yet to see a nonfiction creator go like mainstream on book talk. But it is interesting that this social media platform is ending up promoting reading, physical reading, and this author Colleen Hoover, who writes a lot of these romance books, just like outsold Agatha Christie and like Shakespeare. And so it was like a crazy, yeah, I could be wrong about that, but she outsold like a bunch of someone crazy. So I'm wondering like if you think that all reading is good reading.
I think all reading is good reading. I had a teacher in ninth grade, the same guy who gave me the Postman book, How to Watch Television News. And so at the beginning of ninth grade, we had some terrible teacher. I don't remember who it was even, 25 years ago, but they got fired after a couple of weeks, and this guy named John Goldman came to work at Beacon. And he eventually became a colleague of mine when I came back to work there. But he's the best teacher I ever had. And I love comic books. And I remember he came to class the first day wearing the Spider-Man. Okay, this is gonna be cool. And just really, over and over drilled into us that just read something. And so whether, comics or I love fiction. I love Ken Follett. So just another book. I love the Century Trilogy. I'm reading this, I think there's four books right now about at Kingsbridge, which is like a place in England. It starts in the 10th century. focused around a cathedral. It sounds really boring, but it's not. And it's all hand font, and that's $8.99. It's all books you pick up at the front of a grocery store. I don't even know if grocery stores have books anymore, but they used to have books in the grocery store. So yeah, read that. Read Ken Follett. So you don't have to read Olutosemi Taiwo. I think anything you're interested in, just to say that if TikTok is getting people to read, that's fantastic. And I don't have anything to say about that. I do think about the historian Timothy Snyder talking about Putin. Maybe about a year ago, I saw an interview, and he said something. It's sort of like a throwaway, but he said, "I think it's very clear that the internet, for all its benefits, the access to information, has made life much worse." And I thought, okay, this is a serious person saying this. I have to think about it. And so I think about it quite a lot. And so it's not to take anything away from, the good parts about, TikTok or Instagram, in that, next people communicate for very low cost. But I'm inclined to also think that the cost of the internet are much, much greater than the benefits.
That's interesting. So another thing, I know you talked about this on a podcast episode of yours, but it's about the internet as well. I just think that th your thoughts, I think you said it in class too, but your thoughts on ChatGPT are very interesting as a high school teacher.
Okay, so I go back and forth. It depends on the weather, how I feel, how scared I am of ChatGPT. But I basically am not that worried about it in my own class. I'm really concerned about what it does to our politics, and yeah, there's a lot of things I'm nervous about it. But I think in terms of my classes, I'm not that worried, partly because I think if you're doing good inquiry teaching, that is, you give someone a question that they're interested in and allow them to go explore the answer. And this is really important, that what's, I wish more college professors did this, but our job as high school teacher is not to give kids the answer, because we don't really know the answer. And I think maybe college professors are in a better position to know their subject better than, 99.9% of the population. But even then, I think people aren't really that interested in being told the answer. I think much more interesting is to say, look, here's an interesting question. I don't know what the answer is either, which is true. Let's go figure this thing out. And if you do that, and it's more like CSI, you're an investigator, well then, there's not much need for ChatGPT. Especially, I'm thinking about the kind of projects we did in our class last year. You guys made a podcast around some issue you were interested in. You interviewed three experts. You did an incredible job. I don't think AI would have been all that helpful there. I think for the kind of papers we're asking kids to write, so much of what we're doing is teaching the research process in class. So we spend weeks with books, taking notes by hand. Well, the AI is not going to be all that helpful there. So I think if you give people, especially real world problems that kids are interested in, one idea I have for advisory this year is, right now in New York, there's a crisis that people are migrants, people seeking asylum are coming to New York, and they don't have anywhere to live. The city's not sheltering, cannot shelter all of them, according to our mayor. So one thing I was thinking is to design advisory, but you could do a ninth grade whole curriculum around. What if what we did is we, and our school is pretty close to a not-for-profit, which is helping to give clothing to people who need it, migrants. What if we went and talked to the migrants, found out where they're coming from, and then, each month you try to figure out, let's say it's Venezuela 1 month. What's going on in Venezuela? Why are people coming from Venezuela? And you do a deep dive into that question. I think that'd be something that kids would remember for a long time. It's meaningful because it's happening right now in New York City, and they'd have a why. And I think often what's hard about consuming the news, that you don't have filters, and analysis is difficult then, and you sort of want to give the kids the tools to analyze.
Two questions. So the first thing I was going to ask was about high school teaching and why you chose to teach high school as opposed to, say, elementary school or middle school or even college.
Well, so I went to graduate school first to go into international development. Like, I thought I would work for somebody like Doctors Without Borders, so go maybe work at the UN. And then by the end of that program, I loved the program, but I had dinner. I was in Amsterdam. That's where the program was. I had dinner with a friend from America, a kind of a mentor. He really urged me to consider going into teaching, and that dinner really changed my mind. So I went back and got another master's degree right away, and I went into teaching. And even while I was in the grad program, I knew that it was something I probably wanted to do forever. I don't think, like, I would never want to be a principal, and I just can't imagine enjoying the job as much as I enjoy it. So I sort of never really considered doing anything else. I don't think I'd be very good at most other jobs. In fact, I've been working, in one job or another since I was 16 years old. Mostly, working in sneaker stores or waiter, but all sorts of things. And I was terrible at all jobs. I did decide this, which I feel like I'm like pretty good at. Could always get better, but pretty good at. I think I'd be a bad elementary school teacher, but I don't even really know how they fit a day. It feels like the day is, very long. Middle school kids are difficult,
They're the
and
worst. They're awful.
but college, I taught a couple of college classes over a couple of years, and so in the summers, and so I would like teach weekend seniors, and I went to go teach these, went to teach these college classes, which were in Italy, and a kind of an international university. What they were like, American students who wanted to go abroad in Italy to get college credit. There were kids from all over the United States, University of Florida, University of Michigan, wherever. And these were econ classes, and it was night and day. The kids at Beacon were so much better than these college kids. And one of the reasons why it would be miserable being a college teacher is that the kids were just like, they had their laptops open, and they were like shopping on Amazon or looking at ESPN while the class was going on. I couldn't like really say anything because, it was a private institution, and I was worried. I really wanted to keep coming back and working at the school in the summer. And so they were like my customers. And so, they'd be on the phone, didn't say much. There's no parents to call when students aren't doing their homework. They were just like much worse students. And it surprised me how little, and some of these kids were going to good colleges too, whatever that means, and how little they were engaged with the world. And they were nice people, but it made me really appreciate Beacon in particular, you guys.
Do you think that you have a more a greater impact on younger students in terms of like fundamentally kind of, shaping something?
I have to be honest. When I first started teaching, I really believed that the work that we did was, that I would have a big impact. And I don't think that that's true anymore. I think that the best thing that can be said for what I do when I'm doing it well is that the kids come out of the class liking history, and they have a good memory of, like, that was a good class. The history is kind of interesting. I think when you're younger and you just like you have a bigger ego, you're more sure of yourself, and you tend to think that like what you do is going to make bigger impact. I don't really believe that anymore. I was also talking to a friend about, the process of getting hired. I got hired in 2005, and I really had ideas that I firmly believed in, things that I knew to be true, and I came across as very confident in those interviews. I think if I were to interview today, I'd be so bad because I think I'd say I don't really know for a lot of things. I've lost confidence, but I think in a way it's just a sign that I've read more, and I just realized how thin my knowledge was, Steve. But I think that makes me, to go back to what I was saying before, I think in a way it makes the fact that I'm like with the kids, I'm explicit. Like, I don't know really what the answer here is, but I think it may be this, but maybe not. I think that makes it so that the kids feel like, all right, let's try to figure this thing out. So maybe it makes me a better teacher in that way, that I'm less confident now.
So I have two things there. So I think you're selling yourself short. I think that you do shape a lot of kids, at least experience in high school and experience outside of high school. I feel like, at Beacon, you're a pretty infamous teacher, and people are like, I've never had, like people are like, oh, I want to take Mr. Moscow's class. I had a friend, he was like, oh, I was like, you have to go do international political economy. You have to take it. And he was like, I don't know if I want to do a hard class during second semester. And I finally convinced him. And he was like, I don't think he's going to be able to be life-changing teacher. And he came out of that class being like, I get it. Like, I get what all the hype is about. So I want to give you a chance to be like, why do you think that people and kids keep coming back to your classes? And, they're not easy classes. It's not like they're an easy A. So what do you think makes you a good teacher? I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, that's very nice to hear first, I should say. Well, let's, yeah, if we start from the premise that I'm an okay teacher, I'm a great teacher, I think then I would say I have a podcast. That's not what makes me a good teacher, but just to say, I have a podcast where I interview economists about economic issues that I'm interested in, articles they wrote, books they've written. But like, I always go into the interviews genuinely wanting to know the answer to something that I don't know the answer to. And so I think that I am learning a ton in the last 5 years since I've been teaching, since I've been on the podcast. And so in that sense, I'm learning a lot, and I'm able to bring that, what I'm learning, to the classroom. I'm also able to, so much of what I put together for you guys last year in terms of the projects was it came out of my own interest. And like, hey guys, like let's find the answer to this thing. So I think it's that. I think besides the content, I take people seriously. Actually, I was listening to Noam Chomsky, another person that I would tell people they ought to read, and he wrote a book. He has a book of interviews, which I'd start with, because again, like, simple is good. It's a book of interviews called The Essential, no, called Understanding Power. But anyway, I was listening to him on another podcast with Tyler Collins, who I like a lot too. He's a libertarian, the conservative economist. I like him a lot. And he had Chomsky on. He's very open-minded. And he asked Chomsky why, Chomsky's one of the most important intellectuals alive. And he asked him, why do you respond to every email you get? And he said, because I take people seriously. And I thought that was so powerful. And I really do take the job seriously, and I take kids very seriously. And I think maybe that comes across. So I work hard, but like, it doesn't feel like hard work because I'm interested in the stuff. I want kids to work equally hard, so I hold them accountable, and I think people want to be held accountable ultimately. I don't think people want to be bored. I mean, I see it with my daughter, who just like so excited about life, so excited about exploring, so excited about learning. And then you look at like, the average 12th grader in the average class, the average school, they're like not that excited about learning, about life or whatever. And something, so like, okay, like there's probably lots of causes for that, but I think the main cause is that like our education system is not very good. Again, for a lot of reasons, we're kind of doing it wrong. So I hope that answers the question a little bit, but I think just like taking people seriously as intellectuals. And this kind of goes back to another important thinker, this guy Antonio Gramsci, who's an Italian theorist, who's dead, but He writes a lot about, you know, organic intellectuals, what that means, and this idea that, well, everybody's got that kernel in them to be an intellectual. And I firmly believe that. You know, maybe one example I've given in class before, but it's, you know, it also comes from Chomsky too. But, you know, talking about listening to like the radio, like sports radio, and it's like incredibly insightful comments that people are making. And people are not stupid. But you ask them to talk about foreign policy, and they're like, well, you know, I don't know. That's above my pay grade. I don't know anything about that. I can't talk. Of course, you could, but it just doesn't feel like an arena where people feel like they can enter that conversation, which again, I think is a problem of democracy.
For sure. I also wanted to ask, going back to interviews and podcasts, and I think this also relates to, what you think makes a good teacher is, what do you think makes a good interview?
Well, the person I like, I really like Ezra a lot, Ezra Klein, but the person I like the most is this guy, Tyler Cowen, who I think, you know, one of the things I like about libertarians, I'm not a libertarian, but one of the things I like about libertarians is that honest libertarians really are some of the most open-minded people around, very interesting people. And Tyler Cowen is very interesting. So one, getting people on who are, and I made this mistake early on, but I really try to avoid it now. Getting people on who have a worldview that may not be your worldview is really important. And who will challenge you. And there's nothing more boring than listening to a podcast where, you know, the people are basically just confirming each other's ideas. So I think Tyler Cowen does a great job. So one, you want to find, and Ezra does a good job finding people, really interesting people in different fields. But one of the things I like about Tyler is that he get someone on and he asks them about their whole body of work. And that's something I don't do with my show. I really usually ask them about a specific book or article they've written. But he, you know, he spends, you know, probably months reading everything they've done and then saying, look, how do you feel about this? What do you think about this? I also, one of the questions I really like, and I started to ask my guests this, is what do you think you're wrong about? And the kind of answers, when people are being honest, the kind of answers you get are, you know, are fantastic. I give you one quick example. I was asking this guy who's a medievalist, he studies medieval economics and feudalism. And I was asking him, you know, okay, what's the thing at the end of the century? What do you get wrong? And he said, okay, so the biggest problem is that being able to tell a coherent story about what is feudalism or what were the Middle Ages. Well, it's actually impossible because feudalism was really different, you know, say in Italy than it was in England. And the problem as history teachers or professors or writers or whatever, podcasters, is we have to come up with a coherent story to tell people. Otherwise, like people won't tune in or they won't listen to you. You can't come into a situation and say the thing is too complicated to explain. You have to give people a story. At the same time, every time you're giving people a story, you're misleading them a little bit because life isn't a coherent story. So, but that's the way people remember things. And so what he was saying is, you know, we're actually lying to people when we say this is what X is, but it's a challenge that is all, you know, all historians face.
So I'll ask you, what do you think you're wrong about?
I'm wrong about so many things. I don't know. I mean, like one thing I've been thinking about a lot today and these days is the story of profitability. I'm not sure that's the answer you want, but just like I don't know. I you know, sometimes I teach that profitability has been low since the neoliberal era. I actually don't know if that's true. So much of what I read says it's not true, and then lots of what I read says it is true. But I teach it anyway, like this, or like capitalism. I've been teaching for the last 18 years. This maybe is a better example. I've been teaching the story of capitalism as, I'm not going to get into it, but as basically starting with 1492 and this inflation problem, silver coming back to Europe and so forth, and it destroys feudalism. I don't actually think that that's the story. I think that's a story. It's a story I got from an economist named Robert Halbronner when I was in college. But the more I learned, the more I realized that's actually not it. But I still teach it because I don't really know the answer, and I know that's probably wrong, but I'm not like I haven't like got my mind around it yet. But you know, we can go back to the beginning of the conversation. I don't know if having kids read the New York Times is a good thing. In the end, I know a lot of kids, their mental health suffer. I don't know if, you know, my homework policy is a good thing. I give homework every night and kids have to turn in on time. I'm not sure that that's the best way that kids learn. I think people resent that. I think people like the class when they like it in spite of the homework, not because of the homework. So look, I'm like, I could be wrong about so many things. There are big disagreements, I'd say, with teachers that I like very much about the role of a teacher. I strongly believe that our role is not to tell people like this is the truth. There are, you know, I tend to think that most things we can debate. Whereas a lot of great teachers believe that, like, no, actually, like our job is to give people answers, and maybe they're right about that.
So, and then going back to the question prior to this one, what do you think some of your favorite interviews are?
That I've done or
Yeah, that
anybody.
you've done, that you've done.
Well, I interviewed Ola from Taiwan. That was really interesting. The question was about whether or not capitalism is always racial capitalism. In other words, could you have capitalism without racism? Like, you've never had capitalism without racism. Could it be? I think that was a really interesting one. I had an interview with a scholar, studied Malcolm X and looked at his economic philosophy, which is really interesting to me because, you know, I've read many Marable's biography of Malcolm X. I'm really into Malcolm X. I've read his autobiography, read a lot about him, but it was never very clear to me, you know, if he thought that ultimately socialism was the answer or whether he thought some kind of black capitalism was the answer. And that was really interesting. I interviewed pretty big economist named James Robinson about the role that the Reformation had on capitalism, on establishing capitalism, where like the English crown took away property from the Catholic Church. And in those places where the most property was taken away, you tended to have the emergence of private property and capitalism faster. And that was a totally new way to think about the origins of capitalism. I'm really interested in the origins of capitalism. And on that note, I talked to a scholar, Adam Gedichin at University of Chicago, who wrote a really interesting book about work called World Making After Empire. And a lot of it focuses on the historian Eric Williams, who makes the famous argument that capitalism, that slavery started capitalism. You couldn't have had capitalism without slavery. And he was really interesting to talk to too. Particularly because I'm interested in Eric Williams, but also we got into a discussion about if for some reason in the 1920s, and particularly 1925, was this kind of magical year for intellectuals and intellectuals in particular from the Caribbean. And so we were sort of talking about what was going on in the Caribbean in the 20s, which produced people, you know, later, you know, we became mature in the 50s and 60s that were so impressive. And so she's sort of talking to me about what was special about the Caribbean. All, you know, all that was so new to me. So again, I'm not sure if I'm doing a great job being coherent here, but those are the interviews that come to mind first for sort of changing my thinking about things. There was one more interview that was cool. There's a woman who's at Stanford who is a big professor of finance that I had her on, and she has a different view than I did about banking. But what was so cool about her is, like, this is years ago, she gave me her number, and then every once in a while she would like write to me and be like, I heard this interview you had with so and so, like he's totally wrong about, I mean, it's kind of like, it was so cool because what I really do want is somebody who I can turn to and say, like, you know, like, You know so much more than I do about this. What do you think? And so that was really cool that I got linked up with her.
And so I wanted to ask why you started your podcast originally.
Well, so I started the podcast because a friend of mine, very bright person, read the newspaper. She's not an economist. She didn't take economics, I don't think, after high school. We'd ended up having these dinners where we would talk about, very basic fundamental questions about, what the Fed did, what is fiscal policy? And she was saying, we should have this conversation on air. We should do podcasts. And I didn't know the first thing about podcasts. I had not really ever listened to podcasts. So she sort of organized everything. And we worked together for a couple of years. And then in the end, I really wanted to do, rather than have just conversations between me and her, do interviews with people. Because again, I have really limited knowledge. I do interviews with people who can teach me things. And kind of in a way, I think I was kind of like, I've given myself a PhD program in economics and finance. I can interview, most people are pretty responsive. I can interview, pretty much, if not everybody, but people I'd like to talk to. It's fun for me. I will say this, I don't get anything from it except I satisfy my curiosity. In other words, so the podcast has, valuable listeners. It's in terms of world rank, it's pretty high. I don't make any money from it. I don't want to make money. I mean, I'd be happy to make lots of money from it, I guess, but I don't think it's not something I'm going to commercialize. I don't think there'd be much there anyway. I don't really get feedback from it. So it's sort of like I put this thing out there. I know some people are listening. I don't know what they think about it. But I don't really think about that much anymore. But I'm getting, I'm learning a whole lot. So I guess that's the answer. I'm learning a ton. I put it like this. I can't believe what I didn't know before I started podcasting. I'm sort of embarrassed that I was even allowed to teach for the podcast because I just didn't know so much.
My last question, and I don't think you're going to answer it. So
Okay.
I'm putting that as like the preface, and you don't have to answer it by any means.
Okay.
But I also think you can guess. You think you have a guess?
No, I don't know what you're going to ask
Okay.
me.
I think everyone at Beacon would be really mad at me if I didn't ask this question, so I think I have to
Okay.
ask.
All
What
right.
is your political ideology?
Okay, I don't think I'm going to answer it in a way that's going to make you happy, but I will try. So I am not a fascist. Let me put it like this. I am really attracted to the ideas of people like Noam Chomsky and George Orwell. I really like Orwell a lot. I really like Angela Davis a lot. I'm really interested in anarchism as a political ideology. And I try to, I've done research projects where I sort of looked at Spain 36 when Catalonia was anarchist and tried to study the economics. I think on a personal level, I don't have the constitution. I don't think my personality fits real well with anarchism because I'm really into discipline and control. My classroom is not the Brooklyn Free School. I think I'd have a really hard time. And that's an anarchist model. So I think I'm attracted to the idea. I don't know if I'd be all that happy being in a, being at the Brooklyn Free School, for example. But I've been doing a bunch of research about post-emancipation Brazil. So Brazil becomes the last country in the hemisphere to end slavery in 1888. And question sort of what happens to people who were enslaved after slavery. I mean, I've really only been focusing on the Northeast. I don't know much about the rest of the country. But the Northeast, a lot of people find themselves in a situation where they're forced to work on the same plantations with the same people they were working before under slavery. Now they're getting paid a small wage. But a lot of people decide to run away into basically into swamps, swampy area where it's hard to be caught. And they create these communities, which are basically anarchist communities. They're stateless. There's no president, and they're kind of beautiful examples of how people might live, and they're not a solution for the world's problems, but it's exciting to study that. We'll just say I'm very, very concerned that we're in a new fascist age, and that we're not prepared for it. That's like one of my biggest fears. And then on another personal level, I have to be careful about how much I reveal. I'm probably more conservative about a lot of issues than, say, the typical vegan kid. But again, I think that's just like my personality, my constitution. So yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's gonna make anybody satisfied, but and I'll just, in terms of my podcast diet, basically sports podcasts, Tyler Cowen, who's right wing, Ezra, who's in the center or liberal, and Doug Henwood, who's a radical, a left wing radical. And those are the three podcasts I listen to most frequently, and I get a lot from all of them. Maybe the most from Tyler, who's right wing. But it's so funny. It reminds me actually of a story. I have a good friend whose mother was in Spanish Parliament some years ago. She's in a very, very left wing party, the most left wing party in Spain at the time. And I was living in Madrid for a summer, and she was there in Parliament. And so she used to invite me to lunch, and we used to hang out. It was fun. Like, I'd go to Parliament before I go swimming, or they'd get the swimsuit on. Backpack, and we'd be eating in like the lunch room. And she was telling me that, it's just like high school, like the conservatives sit with the conservatives. But she was like, I hate sitting with the left and the liberals. She was like, the best, the most fun people are the conservatives. They're just like great. Like, we go, like, they go on like trips together. Right? And I think maybe I'm a little bit like that too. Some of my very, very close friends. I think we're freaking kids out by how conservative they are. So, yeah.
But on the other end of that, you do spend your whole day with a bunch of extremely liberal students.
Well, liberal in some ways, right? Like, I think that they are. Look, most beacon kids end up going to lots of beacon kids. I don't know, most. Lots of beacon kids end up going to, elite private colleges. I think if they were very liberal, they might consider the public option. You know what magazine you might be interested in, other people might be interested in? They only have one edition, but it's called Hammer and Hope. Olufemi Taiwo was instrumental in helping start it. And there's some really good articles in that edition that people might like a lot. Maybe it helps more also. The things that I'm reading, I really like the Black Agenda Report. It's a website. So, like, in terms of the sites that I go to in the morning, I go to the Times and Vox, but also Tyler Collins' blog, Marginal Revolution, which again tends to be more right wing, and the links there are more right wing. But I like the Black Agenda Report a lot. I like Jacobin Magazine a lot. I like a website called Developing Economics a whole lot. It's heterodox economics from mostly from the UK. But they have great stuff. Open Democracy is a wonderful website. Z Magazine, which is Chomsky's magazine, is also great.
So why do you think you've stayed at Beacon this whole time?
It's a good question. First of all, to go back to talking about that experience I had at college teaching and how much I appreciate you guys, just like overall, it's just really nice kids. Everybody's so nice there. And you guys are nice kids, and you guys work really hard. You're really smart. I had a friend, I don't know if you were in the class this year, a friend from USC. She was a professor. She came to talk. Yeah. She came to talk to the kids, and she went back to USC, and she told all of her friends and all of her colleagues at USC, like, these kids at Beacon are amazing. And it's true, you guys are amazing. I went to high school at Beacon, the only high school I really had known. I don't think I'd be all that happy anywhere else. My wife always tells me I'd be very unhappy anywhere else, and I shouldn't even think about leaving. She's probably right. I'm very, very happy at Beacon.
You think that you would send your daughter there? Because I know you asked me about this actually in the
Yeah.
bookstore.
Yeah. And we're gonna have a son actually in October. So I now have to think about my daughter and my son. Well, if she wanted to go for sure, I don't know what she's gonna be like or what her interests are gonna be. I can only talk about myself. I think I would have been very happy socially speaking because you kids are so nice, and I think I would have found a good group of friends. And I see you guys sometimes like hang out, by the piers and just large groups of kids that I teach. I think, oh my, every one of these kids is so cool. I think that there's too much work, like I know that I'm the cause also of it. I don't know the answer.
Thank you so much, Mr. Moscow, for coming on and doing this. You can find Mr. Moscow's podcast, A Correction, a podcast, at acorrectionpodcast.com or on regular podcast streaming services, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. I strongly encourage you to check it out. Also, anything that Mr. Moscow mentioned is in the description. I've made a list because, as Mr. Moscow does in his classes, and apparently, when he's interviewing for a podcast, he has so many references just swirling around in his head. So that's all. Thank you so much for listening.